Okay, so this morning I'm going to do lecture number 4 on Shoji, which covers the section which is accordingly when birth comes, face and actualize birth, and when death comes, face and actualize death. Do not avoid them or desire them. This birth and death is the life of Buddha. If you try to exclude it, you will lose the life of Buddha. If you cling to it, trying to remain in it, you will also lose the life of Buddha. What remains will be the mere form of Buddha. Only when you don't dislike birth and death or long for them do you enter Buddha's mind. I'm using, for my lecture, I'm using Shohaku Okamura's translation, which is, I just realized, is a little different than the one that we're reading. The first line of his translation is, "This present life and death, or birth and death, is the life of Buddha." So I wanted to talk a little bit about why it is that this present birth and death is the life of the Buddha. So, first of all, Dogen's saying very clearly that this life, our life, our individual lives for us, is right now, is the life of Buddha. Not somewhere else, right now. We talked about that a lot last week. So, some Buddhist schools say that you enter nirvana, because Dogen's already said here that he says, just understand that birth and death is itself nirvana. So this life is itself nirvana. But for most of us, we think nirvana is not this life. We think nirvana is somewhere else. We have ideas about what nirvana is. So in other Buddhist schools, in early Buddhist teachings, nirvana, well, you can't enter nirvana until after birth and death. You have to get off the wheel of birth and death to enter this state called nirvana. And it only happens after many, many, many lifetimes. Nirvana is also said in early Buddhism, pre-Mahayana, to be an unconditioned state. An unconditioned state means it's not conditioned by anything. It's not affected by anything. It's completely separate. And our life is considered to be conditioned. We are conditioned by things. We are affected by causes and conditions. So you can see that there's like no getting there from here. So in early Buddhism, that path statement, we would not say that this very birth and death, this life, birth and life, and death, this life, is nirvana. But in Mahayana Buddhism, because of non-duality, in early Buddhism, we say no self. Mainly the interest is in the individual person's attachment to self. So when we talk about things not having inherently existing nature, we're talking about self in particular. But then when that doctrine got expanded in the Mahayana, we're talking about everything, which changes the way we view the nature of our experience. I'll talk about that a little more. So we would say, you know, things are conditioned and things are also unconditioned, and reality itself is beyond conditioned or unconditioned. So there's not getting caught in one side or the other, not being caught in some notion about problems or about conditioned states being bad or unconditioned states being good. So there's this kind of holding of both and going beyond some notions and ideas that we have about either one. The other thing about early Buddhism is it said that there could only be one Buddha at a time. There couldn't be more than one Buddha. And if you were going to become a Buddha, you had to receive the prediction of your Buddhahood from a living Buddha in which you were also present. So the Buddha would actually physically say to you, you know, you will become a Buddha in a future lifetime. But you could see that Buddha state is this state of nirvana. So you could see that this was like difficult. This would be very hard. So it was a very rare thing. And there were eons and eons from one birth of a Buddha to the next. But in the Mahayana, there's a different idea about the nature of what it is to be a Buddha, because Buddha becomes, the definition of Buddha becomes, say, talking about everything being interconnected and interpenetrating. So that's, we talk about Buddha nature, the nature of a Buddha. So what does Buddha become? Buddha becomes our actualization of that. Our Buddhahood is an actualization of that. Dogen talks about in Busho, he says that there, he says Buddha nature is actualized simultaneously as Buddhahood, or Buddhahood is actualized simultaneously with Buddha nature. Buddha nature is the true state of things. So this is the nature of the true state of things, is the nature of what we're saying is Buddhahood, right? Which is this, Buddhahood would be this way in which we actually realize, actualize, express our complete interconnection with and interpenetration with all being. This is compassion. When we are able to actually respond to our world in a way that includes everything, it becomes compassion. Compassion in English means passion with. So pity is a near word to compassion, but pity is very hierarchical, right? Pity is, you have pity on someone. So it's a very hierarchical, vertical state. Compassion is a horizontal state. Wisdom technically refers to this complete interconnection and how we express that. So that's prajna, that expression of prajna, of wisdom. So they're actually the same thing. Wisdom and compassion are exactly the same thing. We're completely expressing what wisdom is, non-duality is, then what we're expressing is compassion. Our response will be compassionate. So this becomes the definition of what Buddhahood is. In Mahayana Buddhism, as opposed to entering into this unconditioned nirvana. So when we start talking about it this way, when we have this doctrinal understanding of what this is, then this very life is Buddha. This very life is where Buddha happens, because it's not some other place. It is everything. It's right here. Everything is reality itself. Reality itself is Buddha nature. Reality itself is Tathagata, thus gone one, thus come, thus gone. Simultaneity of coming and going, in its best sense. So this is suchness. So this, when we start to talk about it this way, then we see that Buddhahood is an expression of the highest truth. So that happens, this present life, this present birth and death, is the life of Buddha. So in order to live that truth of Buddha in this present life, we are in connection with all being. That's the activity of a Buddha. That's the response of our Buddha side, our Buddha nature. So you can see there's this way in which we are never not Buddhas, right? We're never not this event, yet simultaneously where we engage in delusional behavior, we engage in selfish behavior, we engage in things that are not particularly helpful, that would not be the activity of some being that was fully expressing its Buddha nature. But all of that activity is happening in this present life. All of that activity can be completely ripe and full and expressed in this moment, not some other moment. We don't have to wait. We don't have to receive prediction. Life itself, I would say, is this prediction of Buddhahood. That was one of the things that makes the Lotus Sutra so important in Buddhism, is that the Lotus Sutra predicts everybody is Buddha. In the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha proclaims everybody has already received prediction. You don't remember it, you don't know about it, but you got it. So everybody's got that. So we are essentially, we are the stuff of a Buddha, and we have to practice in order to express it. And when I say practice, practice can be, we can talk about practice from the position of formal practice. We come and we do service, we sit zazen, we follow the forms, we learn various things. So that's a kind of practice. Dogen talks about practice realization. This practice that we engage in is the expression of Buddha. Sitting zazen, Dogen says, sitting zazen is an Buddha being, is a Buddha expressing itself. It is the dignified activity of a Buddha. So that's one way to talk about practice. We can also talk about practice as it is the activity of a Buddha, period. It's like what do you, you know, when you have this aspiration and vow to express your deep connection with all being, with your desire to be concerned about what's wholesome for the totality of the situation that you're in, and be concerned about being able to express that in the most skillful way that you can, not excluding yourself in that, right? Because you are part of the picture. You're not like separate. Sometimes we get caught in that. We say, all we can think about is the other. And so we never include ourselves. That's a problem. Or if we're over on the side of only thinking about ourselves, that's a problem. So this way in which we take in the totality and say, what is most helpful here, which has to include what is the most wholesome thing for me, and what is the most wholesome thing for the group, for what else is going for the other person. So sometimes that's really difficult to discern. Our practice is messy. It's messy. We would love it to be nirvana, right? This idea we have about nirvana, we would love to be that. But as human beings, it's messy. The Shin Buddhists, you know, they say foolish human beings. So we're doing our best to figure this out. And we're going to fall down, and we're going to get up, and we're going to fall down. And sometimes we're going to be great, sometimes we're not going to be great. But then we have this vow and this aspiration to try to connect with, try to express this true person that we already are, trying to bring that forward. And so that's what I think the formal practice is, right, is helpful for that. These guidelines that we receive, following the precepts, what are the paramitas, all those things, they help and guide us to know what that's about. Because you can't always say, I'm in an interpenetrating, non-dualistic relationship with the world. That's what I should do. So sometimes we have to say, is this stealing? Am I taking what's not given? Am I killing a spirit? What am I up to here? What's going on here? Again, that's what teachers are good for, to help us figure that out. A teacher's job, partly, I think, or mainly, perhaps, is to know who you are and to see who you are and to be able to say, nope. As Ajahn Chah supposedly famously said, teaching is the students walking down the path and the teacher goes, nope, over to the right, no, a little more over to the left, you know. So this way that you know the student and you say, you know, maybe you might consider being a little more over here rather than over here. So, so this present life and death, as Shohaku Okamura says, are birth and death. This may be more common. But life and death is nice too, because it focuses it on this life, you know, this life. So hopefully you can now see why this present life or birth and death is the life of a Buddha. We can only express, I think we only express Buddhahood in interactive, in this life, interacting. It's not an abstract concept. It is juicy. It has texture. It has particularity. You don't express Buddhahood in the abstract. You're expressing it in the particularity of your life, in individual particular interactions that we're having, not in some kind of abstract way. I would say, though, that it is helpful to have some notion of what you're up to, some model of what you're up to. So we have that. We do have an actual kind of path that we're following. We also have to be careful about that and not get caught in some preconceived ideas we have about it. Like a preconceived idea about nirvana is, I will never suffer again. I will never have problems. But maybe you don't say it in nirvana. You'd say, well, if I were Buddha, I would never have any problems. If I were Buddha, I would never suffer. If I were Buddha, I would never say the wrong thing. But how much of that is about saving ourselves from our own embarrassment of being ourselves, or saving ourselves from our own from the need to really see our life as it is, which is that it's messy. We would like it not to be messy. We would like it to always do the right thing and have the other person recognize that we just did the right thing and never cause us any conflicts. That could be very boring, but since we don't usually have that state happening 100% of the time, we don't think of it as boring. We think of it as an ideal. So it'd be interesting to ask yourself, like, what do I think? You know, what do I think I'm doing here? And then maybe just let it all go. You know, and really just be there for what's arising in the moment. So this is happening right now. This essential Buddha is your life as Buddha, not someone else's. This essential Buddha is your life. And then the next line is, if we dislike it and try to get rid of it, we would lose the life of the Buddha. So sometimes that's what we do. We dislike our life. In this past statement, talking about Buddhism as getting off, talking about some kind of attainment is getting off the wheel of birth and death, then there is embedded in that this notion of trying to get rid of something, trying to get rid of this delusional life so that we are reborn or somehow attain this state called nirvana. So I think Dogen's also talking about that here. He's making a comment about a particular past statement in Buddhism. But this is also about our likes and dislikes and trying to get rid of things. So I would say that that's probably for us more hitting the mark of our daily lives. I don't think for us we're thinking so much about getting up on the wheel of birth and death. It's not really the teaching of our school. It's not really the focus of our practice. So if we, you know, dislike something, if you dislike your life, then we're not seeing our life as a Buddha would see our life, as someone who is really practicing would see their life. Which isn't to say that sometimes we want things to change. That motivation to change is also part of it. We say we come to practice usually because we want something to change. We want something to be different. And you could say that we dislike it and we want to get rid of it, but the kind of tricky part about practice is it doesn't work that way. We come into it thinking we dislike something, we want to get rid of something. I don't know what that something is, delusion, however we frame it to ourselves, whatever the specificity of it is. But the practice is not about getting rid of anything and not about disliking anything. The practice is about transformation, which comes in actually being present for whatever it is that you dislike and want to get rid of, and accepting and being with that, and watching how that transforms in some way through practice. So we're not really getting rid of anything. Maybe we're becoming friends with it in a different way. So if we dislike our life, then we're not viewing our life as the life of a Buddha. There is a term that's used in sutras often about, it's called a Buddha field. So a Buddha field is the place where Buddhas live. So in this story that I gave you earlier about there can only be one Buddha at a time, Buddhas have Buddha fields. And Buddha fields are always flat, usually. And they're like, there's this kind of, that's the sense of kind of equanimity and perfection. Or a Buddha field might be a place where all the trees are made out of jewels. Or in the Vimalakirti Sutra, one of the Buddha fields is, as we talked about, smell. People just smell, you know, and then automatically they have realization. So it's a really sweet, you know, kind of Buddha field, that Buddha field. But our Buddha field's not like that. Our Buddha field's called the Saha world. So in our Buddha field, things are a little tougher. But you can also think about a Buddha field as your Buddha field. You know, your house is your Buddha field. Your, you know, how do we keep our house? What does our house look like? It's our Buddha field. It says something about who we are. So we can think about, you know, that we are Buddhas and we have a field that we function in. So this is our field of practice. This is our field of practice. And so it's not helpful to dislike it or to try to get rid of it. This is actually a very fertile place, this field. Maybe that's more helpful not to think of it, is to think of it as actual field where we're growing things. You know, this is the farm that I'm tending. You know, this is my practice. I have a very fertile soil here. So don't run away from the farm and try to go to the big city. You know, the big city of Nirvana. We're going to stay on the farm. So in the Shenzhen Ming, which probably many of you have heard, the very opening line is, "The great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences." Have you heard this before? The great way is not difficult for those who are not attached to preferences. When neither love nor hate arises, all is clear and undisguised. So I was thinking about this, that, well, you know, what's a kind of everyday example about these likes and dislikes? So I was thinking about, you know, when you go to dinner at somebody's house and they offer you some food and you don't like it. You know, I'm not talking about stuff that's going to cause you to go into, what is it, anaphylactic shock. You know, we're talking about, you just go somewhere and you don't like food, that particular food. I don't like coconut. Everybody eats coconut now. You know, I don't like coconut. You go to their house, they serve what? Some kind of coconut dessert or something. So then you get, you know, really caught on trying to get rid of that. How am I going to get that out of my life? You know, ooh, coconut. So you go to the dinner and you're like, you know, all you can think about is, how could this person serve me coconut? Why didn't they consult me before they planned their dinner? Why didn't they write me an email and say, I'm serving coconut, is that a problem for you? You know, and then we're like, so we build it all up and then it becomes a real problem. It's like we harbor ill will, we're angry at our hosts, we're, you know, we're really upset, and somebody else likes coconut. Like, what is wrong with them that they like coconut? So we build up this whole story and there's all this suffering and ill will around that. So our practice is to kind of put that in perspective. Maybe put our mind and our generosity and our thoughts on how good the company is. Like, how much we are enjoying ourselves. How much we enjoy the conversation. How much we really appreciate the fact that our host invited us over and fed us a really nice meal. Except for the coconut. So that we really focus on that side of it. So it's not about the suffering of getting rid of something. It's not about the suffering of disliking something. So we put our dislikes into a different kind of perspective, into a different kind of larger picture, in which the emphasis at that point becomes more about the generosity, the offering that's being made, that's happening, this offering of the company that we're keeping, this offering of the joy that we're expressing together, rather than whether or not we were served coconut for dessert. Because we can get totally caught in those kind of silly things, and they really have a big impact on the nature of how we're understanding our life. So this is, he says, if we dislike it and try to get rid of it, so if our, in this kind of mundane example, if you know, we have this mindset of wanting to change the world, wanting to get rid of what we don't dislike, not having any tolerance for that kind of thing, then we lose the life of the Buddha. So this life of the Buddha goes back again to focusing on what we're all doing together, focusing on how we express, support, rely upon each other in a wholesome way. So this willingness to look at our mental constructs about what we like, dislike, want to get rid of, want to keep, and looking at that. So the next line is, if we desire to remain in life, birth, and death, and attach ourselves to it, we would also lose the life of Buddha. What would be retained is simply the appearance of Buddha. So if we desire to remain in life, birth, and death, and attach ourselves to it, we would also lose the life of Buddha. So this is the flip side of the rejection, which is clinging. So that's the flip side of it. So this desire to hold on to things, one of the Four Noble Truths is this desire to hold on to our sense of self in a way that's not particularly wholesome. You could say the example of the dinner, I am a person who does not like coconut. I am a person who should be consulted at all times as to what I will be eating. I am a person who can discern what is good food and isn't good food. And I'm going to let everyone know about it. And I'm going to be, and my good judgment means that I can blame and be unhappy and harbor ill will towards someone who does not share my judgment about what the best restaurant is in Santa Cruz. So you could see this kind of way in which we cling. This is a definition of self, part of our definition. How do we know who we are? How do we know who we are? Part of it is we tell ourselves stories about who we are. I'm a person who likes coconut. I'm a person who doesn't like coconut. I'm a person who, you know, can discern a good restaurant. I'm not a person who can discern a good restaurant. You know, whether or not you can discern a good restaurant is a very important skill. In Northern California, this is one of the paramount skills of living in this area of the country, to be able to discern good food, good coffee, right? Coffee is important. Do you like your coffee really strong and black? Or do you like to have it weak and American? Because American's bad. And if you know good coffee, you are a good person. You are an educated person. You are a smart person, a discerning person. If you don't like the right kind of coffee, you're not so bright. You're somebody who doesn't have good taste. Maybe you came from the Midwest.
Transplants, that's what we call
it. And if you did come from the Midwest, get with the program. So you can see that this is a way that we define the self. And we do this An awful lot, actually, if you look at the way we think about things. I realize these likes and dislikes are ways that we define the self. But actually, those are not true definitions of the self. Those are superficial definitions of the self. Those definitions cause us suffering if we get cling to them, get caught by them. So the next time we find ourselves saying something like to ourselves, or maybe with our friends, you know, in the privacy of our own home, we gently ease into those subjects, right, to find out whether or not we've just run into someone who shares our same discerning taste. So that we can laugh about it, that we can hold it lightly, that we can see that's really not a definition of who we are. Our true self is the self that is willing to presence ourselves for our life as it is, for this life as it is arising in the midst of or with all being, or with the people that we're with, and that we see that. We see and understand the effort that all being, that people are making in their lives and in our own lives, and that how we rely upon that. It supports us as we support them. So not being caught in that and responding to and including everything. Now again, I always feel the necessity to make these kinds of, you know, statements to you, which is, again, to include everything doesn't mean getting pushed around. It doesn't mean anything goes. It doesn't mean, you know, being in the present moment. It's just like, oh yeah, whatever, man. You're not being asked to leave your discernment at home. You're being asked to pay attention to what's happening, to have a kind of flexibility in your life, to not get caught unconsciously in these likes and dislikes, not be caught in our clinging, not be caught in our wanting to get rid of something. Then Dogen's, you know, this includes a willingness to see that things are impermanent. Things change. Dogen says in Busho, he says, Buddha nature, impermanence is Buddha nature. That's an interesting idea. Impermanence is Buddha nature. What is impermanence? Impermanence is change, certainly. But without impermanence, the interconnected part of our lives is impermanence. That's what makes it impermanent, right? It's a process. It's changing. Things are always evolving. Things are always in an interactive state. This is Buddha nature. This is impermanence. They're not separate. I know very few people who want to cling to impermanence. But really, when things are going bad, impermanence is a wonderful thing. Right? So when things are not going well, we don't cling to them. When things are going well, we want to cling to them. Impermanence, really being present for impermanence, is the realization that nothing's going to stay the same. You know? But it is this interactive, changing event all the time. And that somehow we can surf with that, somehow that we can get out there, you know, on our boards out in the ocean of impermanence, and we can surf that. Or as Kansei translates it in the Prajnaparamita Sutra, disporting oneself. I really love that word, disporting. Playing in your Buddha field, disporting yourself. So there you are out, you know. I don't surf, but I love the image of this ocean of life that we're on. That we can, this surfing is a kind of equanimity. Fall off your board, get back on your board, you know. Be in the midst of this life. Okay, so then he said, So the sentence is, if we desire to remain in birth and death or life and death and attach ourselves to it, we would also lose the life of Buddha. What would be retained is simply the appearance of Buddha. So I understand that to be the appearance of Buddha, it would be our intellectual idea of what a Buddha is. And again, as I said before, having an idea about what you're doing is a good idea, but trying to force yourself into some rigid notion of what a Buddha is not particularly helpful. So I've run into practitioners who believe that being a Buddha means that you always have equanimity. So there, it's a kind of false equanimity. It's not real, you know. So somehow they have the force, this particular kind of delusion, people have the force to be able to always respond in this kind of superficial equanimity. And that's an idea of Buddhahood that we force ourselves into. So to pay attention to that, whatever ideas you might have about what that is. And if we're clinging to those ideas, or we're trying to get rid of something that doesn't fit that idea, then that can be a real problem. And that's what I think Dogen's saying here, is that you don't want to have the appearance. It's not about the appearance of being a Buddha. It's about really getting in there. You know the image of a lotus in muddy water? That's about that, right? Here this beautiful flower is, but it can only grow in muddy water. Its roots are in the mud. So as bodhisattvas, we are in the mud. As bodhisattvas, we are in this mud and water. And yet simultaneously, we are a lotus. So those things are happening together. It's not all about being this idea we have about what a lotus is. You know, this kind of symmetrical perfection. There's a root there. There's this real nitty-gritty life experience that's happening here. It's not some kind of notion that we have about some radiance about what a Buddha is. And he says, if you do that, you get further and further and further away from what your life actually is. So this life includes realization, it includes delusion, it's all part of that. And it includes letting that be what it is, and having this mental equanimity to have it be what it is, and yet also respond in some way that is beyond those notions that we have of this or that. So then Dogen says, only when we don't dislike life and death and don't desire life and death do we first enter the mind of Buddha. So this is our response to the impermanent self. This is our response to life. This Buddha nature is impermanence. Remember last week I talked a lot about this 100% being present, as Shohaku Kumura says. This holding the unity and difference simultaneously of our life. Holding the wanting to get rid of, clinging to, and somehow going beyond that in our lives. And that somehow is presencing ourselves for what's actually happening and being willing to be curious about that, being willing to be okay with it being messy. This is our Buddha field. This is our Saha world. This is the field of, these are the roots of our lotus and muddy water. This willingness to be present for that. And when we can do it, when we don't reject it or cling to it, when we can do that, then that's when we start to cultivate equanimity. We have this equanimity. Because when we're trying to furiously get rid of something or furiously keep something, that comes out of fear, and that is a way in which we can't have equanimity in that situation. So this way that we can actually look at what's going on, You know, Dogen says in Kato 20 Vines, he says, and in this is, I'm paraphrasing, but in, you know, in sub practitioners, the idea is that you cut something off. You just cut it off. But he says, actually, the transformation happens by going into the problems. Kato 20 Vines is a reference to wisteria and it's a reference to problems. So he says that you don't cut problems off. You go into and transform the problems by actually being present for them. So that's facing a reality of our life and really asking that koan, what is it? What is it? What's happening? And so practice helps us do that. Practice gives us frames of reference for that. Sometimes we can't do it by ourselves. You know, we can't. Sometimes we can do it by ourselves, and sometimes we can't. We need help. We need somebody to say, have you thought about looking at it this way? Have you thought about, you know, considering this from another perspective? So this 100%, this life, this inclusiveness has to include gratitude. I think a big part of our Buddha mind is cultivating gratitude. This recognition that all of life is Buddha's life. And so how do we perceive our life? How do we live our life that way? And I think the way we do is we just have to remind ourselves. Just have to remind ourselves. So when we're going, ew, coconut, you know, that we don't get totally caught there. We don't get caught in that place. You can have ooh coconut. You don't have to buy coconut. You don't have to go and buy it for yourself. You know, you don't have to take it home with you and eat a lot of coconut. You can skip the coconut when you go to, you know, your grocery store. Because inevitably you are going to run into coconut somewhere else. The opportunity to practice will be there. So not clinging, not rejecting. This is one big Dharma gate to bringing forth our mind of Buddha. Thank you very much.